Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Renee Hunter-Vazquez, and we are talking about Gerald's Game, the 2017 adaptation of the 1992 novel. This is directed by Mike Flanagan, a possible favorite of both of ours, Renee.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, I know on your podcast, the Podmortem podcast, you and your brother and your husband have talked all about Mike Flanagan movies for sure.
Yes. We're big, big fans.
Yes. So anyone who hasn't checked out their podcast, there's a link in the show notes. Check it out. But we're going to dive in and talk about this cast because it is small but mighty.
Definitely.
And I'm probably going to butcher half of the names because that is what I do. I am terrible at preparing and looking up names. But, you know, we'll start with an easy one. Bruce Greenwood. Hard to screw that name up.
Right. That's an easy one for sure.
You know, he is playing Gerald. And it is Gerald's Game that we're just living in. You have Carla Gugino as Jessie. She's been in so many Mike Flanagan things. You know, she's been in The Haunting of Hill House. She's been in other movies that he's done, I'm pretty sure. And you have Carol Struycken. I'm not even remotely sure on that name, but he plays the Moonlight Man. And you might recognize him as Lurch from the Addams Family movies if you have seen those.
Right. And it's perfectly cast as well.
Yeah. Then you have Henry Thomas and Kate Siegel in the flashbacks, you know, playing Jesse's parents. Again, frequent flyers in the Mike Flanagan universe, which makes sense since he is married to Kate Siegel. Definitely a perk there.
Mm-hmm. Easy. Yeah. An easy get.
Yeah. So, honey, you just want to be in this movie, right? You know, this thing I'm doing. Yeah? Okay, cool. Great. Fantastic. But really, that's kind of your core cast. We don't even see three of them most of the time.
Yeah, so, it's very tight.
Yeah. I first watched this when it came out before I had read the book for the podcast, because this was the year before I started Chat Cemetery. So this podcast started, you know, October, November of 2018. And so I had been consuming the current releases at the time before starting this. And I was like, finally, just staring at all of the books for the thousandth time, because when I lived in California, they used to be on a bookshelf right outside my bedroom door in a hallway. So I would walk by them constantly. And I was like, you know what, I just got to read these books. It took a little while to get to Gerald's Game, even though it's a 92 novel. But what was your experience, Renee, with this movie and the novel, if you've read it?
I have. I was a huge fan of the novel before the film, you know, was announced or made or anything like that. I know I had to be a teenager. I remember reading it in my bedroom with the lights off and just a lamp on and being horrified, like thinking that I was seeing something in the corner of my room. And I was positive that there was no way this could be made into a film.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little, you know, a little nervous.
He has a few books that are like that. And I'm just like, how are you going to do this? And another one that comes to mind is From a Buick 8, because It's a very tight novel. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of movement in it. Same with this one. You're stuck literally in one place for 90% of the movie and story.
Right. And it's very, I mean, in the novel as well, most of what's going on is inside her head. So it's like, how would you convey this visually? But I think Flanagan, I don't think anybody else could have done it. I'll say that.
I think that's why we ultimately ended up with two of her on screen at the same time a lot.
For sure.
I know you've consumed quite a bit of King, maybe not quite everything, because only those of us who are crazy do that. But for you, is this story just one of his most psychologically damaging stories?
I would definitely say yeah. I mean, and it's very, reading it, it's unflinching, because you're not only stuck on the bed with her, you're stuck in her head. And so it's, I mean, there's no, in a lot of King books, you have this like secondary story or some kind of distraction, but here you're in it. Like, you're just here.
Yeah. And I think with this story in particular, that's something that's really hard to make compelling on screen. But, you know, I actually liked this more after having read the book, because I understood just how difficult it was to make this movie after reading the story.
Yeah.
You know, the first time I still liked it. It wasn't that I hated it or thought it was a terrible movie, but it felt a little slow to me. And then this time through, I was like, wow, I'm dumb. This wasn't slow at all.
I wondered if, you know, the translation, because I watched it with my husband and he had never read the novel, and he was like, you know, it was pretty good. And I'm like, that was amazing. And so I feel like maybe, you know, that's the disconnect there.
Absolutely. And rewatching it, and I'm not big on rewatching things. I'm actually really terrible at it. I've done it for like Marvel and Star Wars to like refresh my memory, because there's so many movies that by the time you're getting like to the last one, you're like, what happened? When? What sequence did any of this happen in? So, you know, those I'm a little more inclined to rewatch, but you also don't have to pay as much attention to them. Like, those you can easily have on in the background, but this is not a background movie.
Not at all. No.
Unless something is wrong with you. No offense to anyone who might have this on as background movie, but I'm just saying, maybe pick something a little more upbeat.
Just slightly.
I enjoyed this book quite a bit, too. It was one of his shorter books, which I think works for this kind of story he's telling. But, you know, plot-wise, there's not really a lot that happens. Like I said earlier, there's not a lot of movement in this. So what is it for you that just makes this as good of a movie as it is?
I mean, I think it's just that psychological deep dive, and the fact that, yeah, we're seeing these external figures. One of them is herself and one of them is Gerald, but it's all her. And so kind of helping move her along and figure out what she needs to do to get herself out of this, that's all her. And just the growth of this woman who was kind of, I mean, at the beginning, desperate to do anything to save this marriage that does she even really want to be in? But she's still trying, to watching her stand up to, I mean, horror, basically. It's just it's a pretty great journey.
I completely agree, and I think having the flashbacks really helped. Sometimes flashbacks can be very hit or miss for me, and I know there are certain King adaptations, like Stand By Me, for instance, where the entire thing is a flashback. So it has a very different feel until the end and you're like, oh, this dude's old. Okay, you know, but this does a very good job of transporting you back to a time that ties in with the present day in a way to where it doesn't feel forced, because we're basically getting to see her memories play out.
Yeah, definitely. And again, we're kind of trapped with her, and like, and especially in those flashbacks, there's moments when you're like, okay, can we go back to the bed now? Like, can we, I'm done. But you know, no, he really makes you sit there with her, and we're all going to go through this together, you know, for better and worse.
It's wild when you're like, wait, let's go back to the other dire situation. Arguably exactly. More dire, because she could literally die, and you know, we'd prefer that because it's a more comfortable thing for her.
Yeah, let's go back there.
But it just goes to show too how King will put kids through such traumatic events, and not all of them are as traumatic as this by any means. You know, you have Charlie from Firestarter on the run and people are after her. You have all of the Losers Club and it being bullied, you know, by actual humans and Pennywise.
Yes.
So King loves to put kids through the ringer. And I think this is one of those stories that it's just so reprehensible what happens to Jesse as a girl and as an adult. And it's hard to find like an uplifting moment in this movie, and yet it's still so good.
Exactly. It's like you're suffering with her for what, an hour 40 plus. And
yeah.
Then it's like at the end, why do I feel good? Like, why do I feel uplifted right now?
And I think the end scene, while not wholly necessary, does help with that, because it does end on this like triumphant note, which King has endings that are kind of like happy endings, if you will, even though so many bad things happen to get there and there's still loss and suffering in those endings. But with this, you know, seeing it visually, you're like, okay. And I didn't care for the court scene, and I'm jumping ahead a little here because there's definitely a scene we need to talk about that happens in that bedroom, and everyone who has seen it knows exactly what we're talking about. But, you know, it was just such a stark difference from the rest of the movie that I was like, oh, this very brightly lit room and, you know, this very tall man who she doesn't think is as big as he was in the bedroom, which is kind of wild. But, you know, for you, start to finish, did you feel like everything was in the right place? The pacing was right?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting that you said that about the court scene, because I was, you know, looking at Letterboxd and stuff, and a lot of people did not like that court scene. I thought that was really interesting. But as for the pacing, I mean, I can see how somebody might think it's slow. I really do. But you're kind of, I mean, it's just misery on top of misery. And let's be miserable, you know, in the past at this lake, and now let's be miserable at the bed. And so, I mean, it's like, I didn't really interpret that as slow, because it is just so like emotionally exhausting. So, I mean, I had no problem with the pacing.
Yeah, I think it was really well paced on a second watch. And again, I was like, what was I thinking the first time I watched this? Was I tired? Was, you know, was something else going on? Because I think with a movie like this, depending on your mood going into it, it can really affect what you think of this movie. And this is not super high in rewatchability factor necessarily for me. I did it because I was like, okay, I remember the movie, I remember what happened, but I need to see it again. And, you know, I'm glad I rewatched it, but it's one of those movies where I'm like, I don't really need to ever watch it again. I could if I really wanted to, but it's a tough watch, and it's a tough read too when you read the book, just because of how much you're inside Jesse's head even more in the novel. And here, you know, when they flash back to the eclipse, this is actually tied to Dolores Claiborne. So you have the eclipse happening in that story. And, you know, these books came out one right after the other. So they're kind of set in that same time period. And, you know, I wish maybe they would have like shown some of Little Tall Island kind of like off in the distance or something, just to kind of make that connection in the movie, because I don't think it was super clear unless you had, one, already read Dolores Claiborne, or two, watch the movie, which is also fantastic. But, you know, I do like that King kind of had that little connection there with these books that came out right next to each other.
Yeah, I completely agree. The first time I had read Gerald's Game, my mom was like, okay, but you have to read Dolores Claiborne right after. And I was like, okay. But I mean, it's very, they kind of hold each other's hand. And we have this representation here in that dream that Jesse talks about. But it's like you said, if you don't know what that is, you're just like, okay, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I really think that with those two stories, you know, they have similar things going on, especially with the two young girls respectively, and very different outcomes, I might say. One, you know, gets rid of all her problems, so to speak, in one fell swoop, and then, you know, Dolores has to take care of the problem herself, which, yes, you know, even though it kind of has the same end result, it's like, oh, he told these very similar stories in very different ways. Both still very traumatic, though.
Absolutely, yes.
So, since this is your first episode on the podcast, I want to ask you what your relationship is like with King in general? Are you someone who more so watches the movies? Are you into reading the source material before watching the movies and TV shows? How does that play out for you? Because obviously Gerald's Game took 25 years to get adapted, which is kind of wild. But again, like you said, it's a hard one. So the right person had to come along, the right, you know, I guess, moment for it. And what a moment 2017 was for this movie, too. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm absolutely a reader of the source material, to the point where when I hear about an adaptation, I get nervous. Like, I get worried about it. My mom growing up was a huge Stephen King fan, and I would ask her, you know, when can I read? And she's like, no, like, you can't, you know. And when I was 10, she let me read The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. And it was a wrap after that. Like, it all King all day. That was it for me.
That was one of the first books I read too. I want to say it was like that and Green Mile, because we have the six books for Green Mile.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, look at these cute little books. I'm going to read them. And I probably didn't understand at the time half of what happened in the Green Mile. And then I read it again for this podcast. I was like, oh, I miss so much as a child. Like, I don't even know how old I would have been when I read those two. And I don't remember the order, because my mom had bought the books, but she never finished reading them. She had bought through like Wizard and Glass in the mass market paperback size. So they were like all nice and uniform on the shelf. And I think she had made it to like Pet Cemetery or something like that, maybe The Talisman. And so basically now that I've been reading all of them, she's like, okay, which ones will I like? Because she's not into fantasy or like sci-fi kind of stuff. So I'm just like, you know, listing them out. And Gerald's Game is one that I think you don't need to be a fan of horror to read, but everything that happens is very horrific.
Yeah, no, couldn't agree more. It's like I said, just misery on top of misery. It is straight horror, I think. But objectively, yeah, nobody's being chased by, you know, Pennywise at the same time, you know?
Yeah, there's no clowns, there's no vampires, there's, you know, this creepy dude who is real, you know, and very odd, strange, what have you.
Yes.
Still love a good dog, though, even if he eats someone. You know, Gerald kind of deserved it.
A little bit, yeah. I'll agree there.
You always have to root for the dog. Those are the rules, except for maybe Cujo. Well, even then, you kind of still root for the dog a little bit. A little bit. Love a good animal appearance. But, you know, that was kind of a running theme through the movie, too, that the dog eating the meat outside. And it was like, oh, that's like $200 a pound. It's like, well, okay, fine. Tell us how rich you are.
Exactly. Weird flex, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it's exactly what you would expect from a character like Gerald. So I love how Mike Flanagan was able to capture the essence of these characters. You know, you have the two versions of Jesse, and, you know, you have the one that's terrified and, you know, falling asleep because she can't stay awake. She's dehydrated and literally surviving off of one cup of water. Like, that's it. And you have the fact that Gerald kind of comes back to life, and you're just like, no, we didn't want you here.
Stay down there.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously, I think we have come to the point where we have to talk about the hand.
Whew.
This is the only scene that has disturbed me the entire time I have been doing this podcast, or, you know, out of any other horror movies or TV shows I've watched. I was just like, oh, here it comes. Here it comes. Oh, still getting chills.
No, it is. And like I said, he's so unflinching. Like, if she's having to deglove her hand, you're going to sit here and watch her every step of the way. And it is just, I was physically squirming. Like, I can't. And I'm a big horror person, so I'm pretty desensitized. But it is just, oh, man, it's unbelievable.
The gore effect on it is just so, so good. and it held up. I was a little worried that it wasn't going to when I rewatched it. I was like, oh, maybe it won't look as good. And I was like, nope, that still looks horrifying.
No, it looks so good that you're like, is Carla Gugino okay? Like, has anybody seen her hand since she filmed this?
Can we confirm she still has one? But that scene alone, I think, makes so much of this movie worth it. Because you understand in that moment how far she's willing to go to survive.
Exactly. And this is a character like her, you know, her mental version of Gerald said, she runs away. She takes off in her mind when things get too real. But like, no, she's here. She did this. She's gonna make it out, obviously, no matter what.
What I want to know is, who buys a bed frame that is that reinforced?
Gerald. Somebody with, I think, some disturbing ideas. I don't think anybody needs a bed frame that cannot be broken.
I understand not wanting to break it, but, you know, like, in that situation, even if the woodwork looks amazing, you're just like, no, we don't want this here. Like, get rid of it. Get rid of the whole thing. And that shelf, I was like, that's a little high up. Like, I guess you're not putting stuff on it that you actually want to reach. And the nightstands were like oddly far from the bed. I was like, my nightstand is like reaching distance. And I was like, she cannot reach it with her leg. I was like, I know you're not the tallest woman in the world, but poorly laid out bedroom.
Absolutely. No, yeah, the point of the nightstand is to be able to reach from the bed. Yeah, there was some design flaws here,
which one can argue that was Gerald's entire plan, because he clearly likes playing games, but, you know, still strange man. Like, no thank you, you can go.
Yes, absolutely, get the dog back in here.
Yeah, so I know it's one of those movies that's a little hard to talk about because we do spend so much time with just her in the bed and, you know, the version of her that she is seeing and the version of Gerald that she's seeing just kind of bickering back and forth. So is there anything specific that you want to touch on? Because I think there are still a few little details we could dive into, but overall, anything on your end?
Well, I mean, one thing I definitely wanted to be sure to mention was that you can really tell that Flanagan is a constant reader.
Yeah.
Because he constantly drops these random King references throughout the film. And again, it's one of those things where, you know, if you haven't read The Dark Tower, he just says all things serve the beam. And you're like, okay, sure. Okay, Gerald. But, you know, us, we're like, oh, that's a Dark Tower. You know, I mean, it's like these little Easter egg treats for us. Yeah. And I just, it's really masterful the way he's able to, you know, kind of weave those in without alienating someone who, you know, might not get it.
Yeah. And, you know, he calls the dog Cujo at some point. And that's a term that so many people use, I think, whether or not they've read the source material, even like right. Anyone sees like this dog barking its head off or, you know, chomping on something. Oh, there's Cujo, you know? So it's always fun to catch those little things. One thing that was not a King reference that I did catch, though, that is definitely like a Mike Flanagan reference now, is the fact that the book she pulled off the top shelf there was Midnight Mass.
Yes. I that's not something I noticed the first time I watched it.
Same.
And when I rewatched it this time, I was like, oh, like I was very excited about it.
And it was like fresh in my mind because I had just watched the trailer for it. So like the fact that we're doing this now and that happened, I was like, oh, I see what you're doing, Mike Flanagan. You're playing chess and the rest of us are playing checkers.
Exactly. And on top of that, in Hush, that's the book that she's writing, the main, you know, Kate Siegel.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's like a Mike Flanagan universe that he's kind of cultivating, which is just, I'm beyond here for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if he is down for movies, TV shows, whatever, I am in. And I wouldn't say this is the movie that necessarily cemented that for me. It was probably more so The Haunting of Hill House, if I'm being honest. And then, you know, this Dr. Sleep, he's just, he has such a track record. And I know there's stuff he's done that people don't love, which you're going to have that with every person in film and TV. You know, you're going to have things you love and things you don't love. But, you know, this is definitely top tier. This is a very good King adaptation. And, you know, I have sat through many bad ones, many, many bad ones. And it's always so nice and refreshing, despite the dire situation and the horrific things that happen in this, to just get something that understands the source material so well. And that's not a knock on any of the other filmmakers who have done King adaptations, but some of them, you know, are based on their circumstance, you know, lower budgets. They were TV adaptations, you know, Netflix is throwing money at things. So, you know, if you get something on Netflix, you know at least the quality is going to be there. Like, you're not going to find a boom mic in one of the shots like you do in some of the older adaptations.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm grateful that, I mean, I think this film, that was a risk, especially when they made it. They took a chance on making Gerald's Game. And I'm very grateful. I mean, to Flanagan, obviously, and to Netflix, because I mean, this could have not been very well received.
And I don't know if this would have done well in theaters either, just because of the type of movie it is. I mean, if you look at horror box office numbers, you have the stuff that's definitely going to do well. And oftentimes it is Stephen King stuff, but sometimes, you know, you get a Stephen King adaptation, you're like, yeah, maybe this isn't right for theaters. So I think this being on Netflix was a good move.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, again, like you had said, he appreciates and understands, because I feel like if you put Gerald's Game in somebody else's hands, this could have been awful.
It could have been even weirder and not in a good way. Like, honestly, almost none of this movie was about like Jesse's sexuality or anything like that. It was simply about what had happened to her, the psychological trauma that came with it, and her trying to figure out how to deal with it. And even though, you know, Gerald's like trying to play this game and acting like he's turned into someone else, which is, you know, to each their own, but no thank you.
Right. And clearly Jesse, she's like, what are we trying to do? She's not down for this either. So I mean, yeah, no.
And it seems like the one thing that you can maybe say is Jesse's fault is the fact that she never told Gerald what happened. You know, you would think however long they were into their marriage at that point, he would have known, but she still was hiding that from him. And I think that's the only, like, not even necessarily negative against Jesse, but that's definitely like the choice she made.
Right, definitely. But I think it was, you know, admitting it to Gerald would be admitting it to herself. And I think that this was just this, you know, horrible, despicable thing that happened, but we're just going to put this in a box and we're going to put it over here and it's going to be on our mind, but we're not going to acknowledge that it's on our mind. Just like, you know, the manifestation of herself said, you were already in the cuffs. Like, Gerald didn't do this. You've been here. You know what I mean?
What did you think of the fact that once she kind of admitted everything to herself in that bedroom, she was then comfortable going and sharing her story?
I think that, like you said, her never sharing it, never confronting it, kind of could be considered the reason that she was in the situation that she was in. And so I think she's like, oh no, you know, I'm not going to minimize what happened to me. I'm not going to minimize myself. We're going to stand up to my dad and to Gerald and to this, you know, Ed Gein stand-in that was visiting me. You know, she's like, there's power in that and taking that back and not being ashamed of it. She didn't do anything. You know what I mean? So it's like, she's not protecting her dad anymore. She's not. And I think even she mentioned Gerald's, you know, firm covering up with what had happened with them. And she's like, that's just, you know, we're still sweeping this under the rug. No, this is what happened.
she spent so long in this mental prison that, you know, admittedly she put herself in, but you understand why she did that. And, you know, she thought it would protect herself, when in reality we see at the end how much more free she is once she's able to share her story. And I love that character progression for her, because it's slow and painful and you see all of it.
Oh no, she earns every ounce of it for sure. And so I feel like that's why that's such a, the moment in the courthouse when she was like, you know, you're smaller, I thought you were bigger, because she's the one that's bigger. So it's like, you know, I'm not scared. She's not gonna be passive. She's not sitting on the swing anymore. You know, she's done. She's moving forward.
Yeah. Another little thing that I caught on to was the Bag of Bones. And obviously King has a book called Bag of Bones. I don't know if that's what the intention was, or if this guy literally was just like so strange and creepy that he actually did carry a bag of bones around with him, which, given all of like the newspaper clippings and stuff that she found with him being like a grave robber and doing all sorts of other things with dead bodies that no one needs to know about, you know, I was like, oh, she means a literal bag of bones. Okay. But Renee, anything else that you wanted to sort of pick out here and dive into? You know, like we said, it's kind of one of those stories of King's where a lot happens, but so much of it is like an internal struggle for the character. So it's like, you know, it is a little slow, but the payoff in the end is just worthwhile. And like we said, the flashbacks keep that pace moving forward.
Yeah, no, it's, the ending is absolutely worth it, because you're going through this, you know, we're suffering with her. So it's like, I guess want to shout out the performances, because especially Carla Gugino, how, I can't imagine how difficult that must have been. And then the fact that her really and Bruce Greenwood are playing dual roles, you know, so it's like, and then Henry Thomas, I get very excited every time I see him in anything, and he was just, made my skin crawl in this. So I mean, just superb.
Yeah. And, you know, that has to be a role that was not easy for him as a father. You know, he has 3 kids, I think. And, you know, I don't know how old his kids are, but, you know, I think he's almost 50. So, you know, they might be in their 20s. They might be teenagers. Who knows? And, you know, that moment where he's like, well, I didn't touch you. And I was just like, that does not really make it any better. You're just like, well, I wasn't that bad. I could have been worse. Like, you're like, yeah. No. That's not how you should phrase that.
Yeah, no, that was, and even her saying what he did in the room was worse. Like, it is. I mean, you can see this is a child, how he's leading her. And I mean, Mom probably wouldn't blame you. I mean, it's just
the manipulation. Oh, yes. That scene. It was so good and so hard to watch at the same time. You're like, look, Henry Thomas, you're great. We love you. Don't ever do this again.
Please. And again, Flanagan has us right in their faces in that scene. So, I mean, it's just, he's,
you're in the room relentless. With them.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's wild. This is by far one of those adaptations that just kind of makes your skin crawl without having like a ton of gore. You really have like 2 gore effects, really. You have the hand and you have the dog, you know, like ripping meat up and eating it. And that's kind of it. And it's not even like a lot of people are dying. It's not like a zombie flick or a slasher flick. It's just like so psychological that you're just like, okay, we need a break, you know? Just gonna sit here with my thoughts.
Definitely.
So, Renee, if there isn't anything else, I like to talk about ratings. You know, obviously, we both really enjoyed this. I gave this a 4 out of 5. I think, you know, just the courtroom scene was kind of that one thing for me where I was like, we didn't really need this, because it almost felt like they brought her in just so people would hear him talk. And, you know, because they had mentioned that he wasn't talking or something like that. And then he sees her and all of a sudden he talks. And I don't even think I understood what he said, but, you know.
He's like mocking her, what she told him in the house, because I feel like we're in this weird unreality with Jesse for a lot of it. And, you know, Gerald's dead. Oh, no, wait, he's standing and talking to me and I'm free. Oh, no, wait, I'm still on the bed. And so you're almost like, was this real? You know, and I feel like that moment is like, no, this was an actual monster that, you know, she gave her wedding ring to. But
yeah, and I don't think they ever found it, did they?
No. No.
So then you're like, I don't want to know what he did with that.
Not at all.
So what is your rating for this?
I mean, I'm sure this isn't a big surprise. I would vote for Mike Flanagan for president if I could. But on my Letterboxd, I definitely gave it a 5 out of 5 because the book, I just love the book so much. And I was very like, you know, how can you even make this a movie? But it completely blew me away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am in on Midnight Mass, you know, I'm in on whatever Mike Flanagan does. But Renee, you will be back for the Dr. Sleep episode with your brother Travis, who is one of your co-hosts on Podmortem. So I look forward to that. I imagine we'll have a little bit more to say about that one because so much happens in that.
Definitely. It's action-packed.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me. It has been a blast talking about this, even though it's not a blast to watch.
No, thank you for having me. I had a great time.
All right. That does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.